Thank you all very much for coming. My name is Daniel Finkelstein. I'm chief leader writer of The Times. I think I've been asked to chair this seminar because I can get our main speakers' names in the correct order. Nassim Nicholas Taleb's books, Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan, have made a big impact. One of my friends, Andrew Cooper, when asked whether he had any spare change, replied he didn't know because he hadn't finished living his life yet. our guest speaker has elevated that insight into a way of looking at the world. I would say that he is against trying to judge the result of a football match when it hasn't finished, but then he would accuse me of being guilty of the ludic fallacy, of treating life as if it was a simple game and easy, therefore, to model. But I do think that beyond the immediate implications for financial markets, which have made the book famous, the insight about looking at the world not as a series of individual events, but as a long statistical series in which you might expect different random events to occur and can't make easy judgments at any one point, is a very important way of looking at the world. We don't do it in politics. We don't even do it in history, where we judge historical episodes as individual items, therefore judging, for example, the Vietnam War a failure and the Cuban Missile Crisis a success, even though the decisions that underlay both of them were the same. And so we treat things as individual episodes that might better be treated as series. These insights, of course, have gained tremendous import with the recent events in markets, which seem to vindicate a lot of the financial information that formed the basis of Fooled by Randomness and then the Black Swan. So I'm delighted to have Nassim here to talk to us about some of his work and insights.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. It's very nice to be back here. I think 2.5 years later, I remember the first lecture I gave about the Black Swan. Actually, I was 30 pounds heavier. Was here at the in this room 2.5 years ago, and my argument was not as convincing as it is today. So now it's becoming boring, but at the time it was more exciting because I was shocking people. Anyway, so let me make a few points about my concerns about the Black Swan. People think that Black Swan thinking requires constant paranoia. That is not true. It requires finding out which Black Swans can really hurt you and which domains are Black Swan prone. Let me get the same metaphor I gave here 2.5 years ago. If I randomly gather 1,000 people from the world's population and put them on a scale, they'd be today, you know, they'd be actually heavier than 2.5 years ago because people have been eating a lot of carbs. Anyway, so you have 1,000 people, you put them on a scale, and you add to that sample the heaviest person on the planet. That person will represent a few basis points from the total, what, 0.3%? So you can have exceptions in some domains, but these exceptions are not consequential. However, socioeconomic life is very different. If you have the very same sample of 1,000 people, putting them on a scale, you add up their net worth, and add to that sample the wealthiest person on the planet, how much of the total will that person represent? Not 30 basis points. Okay. He'll be worth 50 billion, and the remaining 1,000 would be worth 1 to 2 million. All right? So you realize that there's some domains in which the exception matters a lot. Unfortunately, socioeconomic life has been much more dominated by exceptions. We have to identify where the vulnerabilities are. We live in a world today that's extremely different than the world we inherited from our parents. Today we have 3 times the debt level, means you cannot make a mistake. 3 times the debt level that we had in 1980, approximately, depending on how you count. You can no longer make mistakes. We have interdependence today, a lot of interdependence. It comes from the internet. Rumors become planetary. So you know what happened. There's some Are you familiar with this device here? Commonly called a BlackBerry, a lot of divorces. Okay. So this bankrupted Iceland in no time. Normally, when runs on a bank take place, you know, people take a tube and go wait in line. All right. Now you do it during dinner. So it can have rumor planetary. So we're much more vulnerable to extreme deviations today than we did in the past because of the tools we have in our hands. We can no longer make the same mistakes. And other things have been happening. Globalization. Globalization makes companies very efficient, but makes them more fragile. So you have operating leverage that's very similar to debt leverage, financial leverage. Okay? Makes companies very vulnerable. So economic life is more and more black swan prone, in other words, prone to huge changes coming from a single event, an exception, than it ever did before. At no time in history have you had such small like imbalances in food supply cause, you know, that spike, these spikes. I mean, wheat prices tripled, and it's not like everybody decided to eat a lot more pasta, all right? Wheat prices tripled in response to a little more pickup in demand, and we had supply, but supply couldn't catch up. Small imbalance. That never happened in history. So we live in a world that's much more fragile than the past. What is the solution? Solution is very easy. Very, very easy. Look at Mother Nature. Mother Nature does not like leverage. Mother Nature does not like too big to fail. Simple solution. If we went, and I'm sure it's not very politically correct, they decided to shoot the largest animal, right? The largest mammal, a whale. Okay, it would be bad. Would it destroy Mother? Would it destroy nature? No. But if we went and shot a firm, say Lehman Brothers, right? You know what can happen. So, you can have interdependence, not a big deal, but you cannot have too big to fail. You want to make sure that if something happens, that the consequences are manageable, right? The second thing, Mother Nature doesn't like debt. The opposite of debt is redundance. I have two lungs. I know in the UK everybody has two lungs almost, no? All right. So I have two lungs, one spare kidney. I have a lot of things. It's the opposite of debt, spare parts. So if we let, you know, economists manage Mother Nature, they'd give one lung to everyone and then you'd borrow, you know, your time for breathing, right? To be optimal. Why have to carry a lung, right? Okay. So I mean, this is so we have a so Mother Nature does not like the Ricardo concept. Okay, if one country specializes in wine, another country specializes in cloth or some other item, right? Because all these concepts that we've inherited from classical economics don't make sense when you stochasticize, in other words, inject some randomness. Well, now, what if the price of wine changes? What if people decide not to drink wine anymore? Well, you have shifts. Well, it's not a good idea to specialize in wine. So Mother Nature does something that's opposite to specialization. We call it functional redundancy or degeneracy. It's doing things that, having function, doing things that are not efficient, are not optimal, but they help evolution. Like, for example, lips, right? They're used for a lot of purpose, okay? Mother Nature, you can use your lips to eat, to talk, to taste, a lot of things, all right? So so it's the opposite of over-specialization. So Mother Nature can show us how to build a robust system, a system that can withstand huge deviations and stay standing. It's very simple. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nassim. Perhaps I could kick off with a couple of observations and a question before Danny opens it up to everyone else. I mean, I very much enjoyed Black Swan, and I'm trying to come to terms with Black Swan thinking and what it might mean for politics. And I wanted to try and ask you to tease out some of the consequences of what you call Black Swan thinking, if you assume that we are going to be hit by as you call them, high impact but low probability events that you can't always foresee. What are the consequences for political thinking? Should it be, I would argue, that means you've got to have an attitude that is pragmatic, not utopian, cautious and sceptical. When it comes to regulating things, you need to have wise people in good institutions rather than thinking you can write a series of rules for every eventuality. But I also want to tease you out on some of the specifics of what your thinking means in terms of the current financial turmoil and some of the specific things that you say. One, for instance, is, I think in general what you're saying is that because of the risks of instability, you should avoid excessive levels of debt. Because of events that can come and hit you, you need to have very strong and robust societies. Those would seem to be obvious lessons. But going down to the specifics, on this issue of too big to fail, hasn't the recent events taught us that actually some of these really quite small institutions needed to be propped up or helped or rescued in some way, because actually even very small institutions can have a systemic impact on the whole. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, in your book you seem quite keen on banning a number of things. A lot of your approach is quite sort of live and let live, and yet when it comes to things like, I think you're in favour of leverage buyouts should be banned. This seems a very risky, in all circumstances, surely there might be some circumstances when some leverage might be a good thing. So I wanted to tease out in some of those specifics the consequences of the very radical thinking that you've been doing. But can I say, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me along and letting me come along and bathe in your reflected glory. Nassim.
To reply to some of those points, I think particularly the last one about leverage buyouts.
Okay. The first thing about political thinking, let me go back to Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Okay. Elephants and the black swan, there's a puzzle. Why do elephants keep old elephants around? Especially the female elephants that they keep around. Okay. Male elephants, who cares, right? Why? What's the obvious answer? Memory, tradition, memory, tradition, embodied knowledge, transmitted knowledge. Okay, so there it goes. There you go. The political thinking is investing experience versus ideas, tinkering, think that what Burke called the collective wisdom of the ages, right? Have more respect. Well, so visibly, I am conservative, all right? I'm actually hyper-conservative ecologically. Ecologically, I don't want to mess with Mother Nature, okay? Even if I don't believe that carbon thing is necessarily anthropogenic, right? I just don't want to mess with Mother Nature. I don't understand Mother Nature. It's much smarter than us. It's like the mother elephant, all right? It's been around for longer than anything else. So Mother Nature has an intelligence that has. So I don't want to interfere with that. Tradition. So. Respect for things, like, I always go back to Mother Nature, things we've been doing for a long time. Respect for religion, to me religion has a function, not necessarily, I mean, I'm from the Eastern Christianity, so we don't believe in beliefs, all right? Religion for us is, do you celebrate Easter, do you fast for Easter week? Okay, so it's good enough, all right? So what I meant is, there is some, because your body tradition, long tradition, that under belief. So there are things that make me conservative, okay, in that sense. I don't like financial instruments that are new. So when it comes to trading, I was a derivatives trader for a long time. And I distinguish between two kinds of derivatives. Those you learn from other traders, there's a chain of transmission, trader to trader as an apprenticeship, and those that require you to go get and then I also taught mathematical finance for 9 years. I distinguish between Brooklyn derivatives, I call them Brooklyn and MIT derivatives, all right? The Brooklyn derivatives can be taught from trader to trader, and these we know how to deal with them. An MIT derivative, okay, is school, you know, there's no chain of experience. You go in, you learn from textbook, and visibly these are the ones that people blow up on, and it was proven right with recent event. Okay, recent events, they blew up the system. Okay, these non Brooklyn products. Okay, so this is, so here is the attitude. Now coming back to debt, debt is can be a great thing if you're right. But if you're wrong, you know, it's not a good thing. All right. So debt equates overconfidence. Debt comes as a product of overconfidence. All right. The more confident you are, the less it makes sense for you to issue equity, all right, and dilute your potential profits, and the more it makes sense to borrow. So the problem, of course, is that we humans cannot be trusted with knowledge because we tend to be overconfident. We're always overconfident. And that's sort of the message of the Black Swan. So the religions have been, you know, Judaism, it's a, you know, the Ecclesiastes doesn't like that, right, as a religion, right? Christianity early on did not like that. And Islam banned that. It's not without a reason. And then I looked, I realized that you had debt jubilees that started, you know, cancellation of debt, turmoil coming from debt, from Babylonian times. The Romans had problems with debt and wars, a lot of wars caused by debt. So debt was not necessarily a good thing. Now, people say, well, in moderation, but we don't know what moderation means. If you ask if you ask someone in Lehman Brothers, right? If you had you asked them 2 years ago, if they always said, "Oh, we have moderate level of debt." Okay, we don't know what it means, so we have to watch out. Debt is something that's very toxic. It can hit you very quickly. All right, so which is why I don't like leverage buyouts, and you need to protect people from themselves. But equity, issue equity, find equity buyers, equity. You can express your overconfidence with equity without harming yourself too much. We had an equity problem in 2000, if you remember,
yeah,
in Silicon Valley, where we had a big bubble. It deflated, no big consequences. Now the debt bubble we have now, we're still here, right? 10 months later, we're still here and nothing changed.
Okay. What about the argument that some would say, well, from your thinking and writing, you'd definitely say when the economy is plain sailing, then that is the time to avoid excessive debt because you should be cautious and prudent about the future. You don't know what events are going to hit you. And this is an argument that's definitely been proved right because those countries with the greatest levels of indebtedness, like Britain, have had the worst experiences of recession. But then running forward after the recession has hit, some would argue, well, you've got then to have higher levels of debt because you're coping with higher levels of unemployment and low levels of growth, and that is just the shock absorbers of a modern economy. And don't you need to let that happen? You need to wind it down as fast as you can, but you need to let it happen because the consequences would be worse.
I agree. Normally, it's like saying, okay, I would borrow if I starve, all right? Yeah. And we always have a father-in-law or someone to borrow from, okay? Except that today there's no father-in-law, all right? There's China left, and we're not even sure, all right, about their ability to finance more debt. So the problem we have today is that any debt that you issue, any government issuing debt is facing the risk of inflation. Because you may have to print it, and we know what happens with inflation; it can run out of control. Worse, now with the internet and interconnectedness and the speed of information and speed of reactions, you can have hyperinflation. So monetary policy. If you take their textbooks, I did something after the Black Swan. I wrote a paper called The Fourth Quadrant, in which I analyzed the errors in economic papers. They all use the wrong model, so we don't know, they don't even know their error rate. I looked at some metrics to show that you cannot use linear regression, you can't use anything you learn in study. It works beautifully for weight, for other things, but it doesn't work in economics, with economic variables. And the economic variable that's the most, what I call fat-tailed, all right, is the inflation numbers. Because, you know, we saw what happened in Germany. Something going from 1 to 3 trillion is a black swan. Okay, so we have to worry about hyperinflation, and I think that the risk of hyperinflation is very high, and the risk of hyperinflation is very high. the story of nonlinearities is you don't know how much pressure you have to put, you know, and how do you get the ketchup out of the bottle? You get nothing, you get nothing, you get nothing, and suddenly you get ketchup all over, you know, the table. So the problem, that's the problem with the policy today. Okay, what to do, all right? Visibly, what Obama is not doing, all right? From the beginning, identifying the problem is that over-reliance on forecasts, and the patient has cancer, okay? They're giving him painkillers. If you give a cancer patient painkillers, what's going to happen to, you know, visibly? The cancer is going to get worse, but he's going to not feel it, okay? So the problem we have in America is that nobody has addressed the fundamental error, okay, is that over-reliance on forecasts. They got Larry Summers, who blew up Harvard. I mean, you know, forecasts, what's going to happen with their endowment, visibly. He didn't read the black swan. And coupled, you know, with expansion plans, and now their endowment is down by a third, but that's the official number. Okay, if you were to mark the market, private equity would be a lot more interesting. So they're going to do the same to the U.S. administration. They're doing, making forecasts of what's going to happen in 2010, 2011, and building government deficit based on that. Okay, this is like they believe in Santa Claus. So what is this? What should we do?
Yeah.
Transform debt into equity. A very simple example: you go to a homeowner who had not been foreclosed, but who has been getting hate mail from Chase Manhattan Bank, right? Like a neighbor of mine, right? You get hate mail from the bank, and it gets longer. The letter gets longer and show you how much more you own. Okay, not foreclosing, right? And the person's frozen, right? So he knows to avoid the mailman on the third Wednesday of the, you know, of the month, okay, when he gets that letter. So the person's frozen. Everything's frozen, right? He owes $6,000 more every month. So what you do is you go to the gentleman, tell him, you know what, pay us $1,000 a month, but we want half the profits from your house. Now you're transforming debt into equity. Very simple mechanism, okay? That would make that person sleep a little better. It would won't look that good on the balance sheet of the bank, but would help them. So you're doing something to address the cancer rather than just giving painkillers. Now, we can give some painkillers. There's nothing wrong with painkillers, right? But let's not give the wrong painkillers. Obama has been, what I was railing against him, is the Cash for Clunkers program. I own a car. I have a car that was fuel efficient. I wanted to get rid of it to buy, I bought a Mini, all right? I wanted to get rid of the other car, all right? I can't, because nobody wants to buy a car. And the Cash for Clunkers program is only for bad cars. So if you made the mistake, bought the wrong car, you get $3,500 from Obama, all right? But if you bought an intelligent car, you get nothing. Secondly, they raise the taxes. Now, I happen to do okay in an environment like this. I'm paying more taxes. So those who did the right thing, how can you have evolution if those who do the right thing have to finance those who did the wrong thing? So if you're making money in 2009, visibly it means you have a business that's robust to the cycle. You're paying more taxes to finance. And if you're losing money in 2009, you get a bigger tax break. All right? So you're financing. So it is the opposite of what, you know, everything I believe in. Okay? And there are other things, of course. More reliance on that economic establishment. Bernanke, let's take Bernanke, the central bank. You guys are blessed with a good central banker compared to what we have. When I was railing against the risks in the system imposed by regulators, the regulators, all right, are the ones who are helping people use value at risk, something completely bogus, okay, that did not take into account black swans, that caused banks to take a lot more risk. And the system was accumulating a huge amount of hidden risks, okay? We were moving into a complex system, so you have quieter markets, but a lot more risk of explosions, all right? Bernanke pronounced that the system was in a great moderation phase. And he tried to explain it. Of course, being an economist, he found explanations, right, of why we're in great moderation. Right when we're sitting on a maximum, on a huge amount of dynamite, okay? So these people are still there, okay? We should do something symbolic to say, okay, the economic establishment failed us. Let's get new economists. Someone who did not fail us. No effort on his part, of Obama's part. He took that old staff. So it looks like it's a reward to those who did the wrong thing. And more power to the regulators who got us here. More power to the World Bank and the IMF, all right, who missed on a crisis. Okay? And they're not even making an effort to reward those who saw this, warn against it. No effort on their part. So here we have, I think they're going to fail. Okay, and after they fail, they're going to have a lot of finger pointing and so on. But we don't need to wait for more failure. All right. So today, 10 months later, we have more debt than before, some transformation of private debt into government debt, and now we have to look for someone to buy the debt. There's a big joke in trading circles that during the crash of 1929, there's a gentleman who told his clerk, sell everything. And his clerk kept looking at him. And he told him, I told you, sell everything. And the clerk looked at him and said, yes, but to whom, sir? At some point, government wanting to borrow, need to borrow from someone, right? It's from whom? From the future, from future children? You can't even do it anymore. Inflation would take care of it. I mean, this is hyperinflation take care of it. So we have a severe problem today.
Let me just ask about your evolutionary suggestion. What is the evolutionary purpose, then, of being fooled by randomness? Why has it survived, and why do we continue to be fooled by randomness if it serves no evolutionary purpose? And after all, if we'd had no financial instruments 2,000 years ago, we wouldn't be where we are. You're very certain that stability is superior, but actually the world, which has been fooled by randomness, has gone through these spurts and these crashes. It isn't such a bad world, is it?
No, I like crashes. I like crashes. I just like to be a world to be robust to them. The world is not robust to a crash. In 2000, the world, you know, of Silicon Valley was very robust. I'm not against finance. I'm against some parts of finance, all right? Like, for example, I'm not against derivatives. I'm against complex derivatives. I'm not against a vanilla option. It's very the nuances. As they say, the devil is in the nuances, or the truth resides in the nuances, okay? That's Oakeshott and also Renan, all right? My two heroes, all right? The nuances, is we have to know. It's not say, investment banking is good, all right? For example, hedge funds. 1,800 hedge funds closed over the last period. Can anyone here in the room name a closed hedge fund? Everybody's focusing on Lehman Brothers. So there is a way to build an ecology, right, in which people can fail aggressively and start again and fail and start again without bringing down the whole system, without being financed by regular Joes like Citibank, right, without having bonuses, all right, financed like, Bob Rubin, $120 million. And then he said, oh, there was unexpected, okay? He kept his $120 million, and we taxpayers, and you can't clone back, okay? So hedge funds are solutions. So the nuances, okay? I'm not against derivatives. I'm against some derivatives, and there's a list, all right? There's some derivatives that are very stabilizing. So we can issue that. You can issue, equity. You can, and actually, that's how growth happened. This level of debt we have today is new. Complex derivatives are new.
What about bonuses, then? Because you're against some derivatives. You're in favor of normal derivatives but not complex derivatives. I asked a question about LBOs. What about bonuses? There's been a big debate in Britain about what we should do about bonuses, regulation of bonuses. How would you reform bonuses?
Okay, I had, and this is a fight that started 13 years ago. Yeah. And 13 years ago, I kept talking about my metaphor of someone who sells out-of-the-money options. So you make money for, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, okay, you're making pennies, okay, and then one day you lose dollars, and then say, okay, thank you very much, I'm sorry, you write thank you, apology letter, all right, dear investor, surely these events are as much of a surprise to you as they are to us, okay, and you close shop, all right, and that was a model, and meanwhile you have your yacht, okay, and you don't care, all right, so there was a mismatch. If you use the metrics of modern finance, you would be fooled after a year or two, Sharpe ratios, beta, meta, alpha, shmalpha, all that stuff. You'd be fooled into believing that that person is actually doing the right thing. So there was a mismatch between compensation period, namely 1 year, and time to reveal the statistical properties, in this case 9 years, okay, or 8 years. And effectively, in a black swan, I was attacked initially because I said that banks never make money. They look very intelligent most of the time. And in 1982, banks lost more, money center banks in America lost more than they ever made in the history of banking. And they said, well, exceptional events. They did it again in 1991, okay? 1991, we had, and then, of course, recently. So I don't need to convince you more with that. Meanwhile, bankers are rich, right? So, but it's very easy to identify domains in which people play that game. It's so easy. It's so easy, it's not even funny. You can figure out if this guy deserves his bonus or not. It's so easy. If I'm giving a loan, all right, that is can be hit only by negative black swans, you see, I don't deserve an annual bonus. If I am in venture capital, where you lose, and once in a while make a lot of money, I deserve the bonus. If you are in what I say, long volatility, if you have... If your business model, right, is R&D, you're going to lose. Once in a while, you discover a cure for a bad breath or something that makes you a fortune, right? Then your statistical properties are not masking hidden risk.
Yeah.
So you should not pay a bonus to someone who has hidden risk. That's very simple. So it's not complicated. The thing is very simple. In my first book, Dynamic Hedging, and people started to read. I finished it in 93. It took me 3 years to publish it, 96, 97, right? So now it's what, 13 years later, people are starting, you know, it was a very simple model. Are you skewed left or skewed right? In other words, can you lose back everything, all right, or not? If you can lose back everything, you don't deserve a bonus. It's a very simple model. So sometimes it's small nuance. Is society subsidizing your risk taking or not? If it's not, then it's your bonus.
Let's open up the floor to questions, to short points.
I'm Sean Luss from the National School of Government. My question really is about groupthink and how groupthink increases our vulnerability to black swans. And if one thinks of a statement like the end of boom and bust or the vulnerability before 9/11, this was in large part a result of groupthink. And I'm just wondering, and I think it's very prevalent inside government where conformity is a sort of natural culture. So I'm just wondering if you have some thoughts about how we can combat groupthink, how we can support people having outlying thoughts that can increase our robustness to black swans.
I don't know if we can counter groupthinking now, okay? It's a little too late. Everybody wants to buy the same book, Harry Potter, you know, effect, okay? It wouldn't have happened years ago.
Black swan.
I don't know if you can counter it. You just have to. I don't know if it's a government job to prevent people from thinking like their neighbor. All right, you can't do that. You just have to make sure that instead of correcting human nature or normatizing human nature, like the Soviets should do this. Okay, make sure that you can handle planetary. Fad, okay. Make sure you can handle fad, and fads are getting more and more, planetary. So just make sure we can handle fad, okay. Now I don't know. I mean, you may want to have a policy to help those who think independently, but I it's not my business. My point is that is it robust to groupthink or not? Okay, make things more robust to groupthink. It's not too complicated if you know the problem. It's just like derivatives, all right? There's some derivatives are okay, some are not. Okay, same thing is some instrument or some policies may, you know, just make you a little more insulated, and that's all that matters.
It's James Kirkup from Daily Telegraph. Just wondering if you could move away from finance slightly to some applications for wider public policy. Your opening observations about specialization and the vulnerability of systems the vulnerability to black swan events. Would you advise someone like David Cameron, who proposes to be running a major economy shortly, should he be thinking about reducing Britain's dependence on imported food, imported energy, manufactured goods, because you can't necessarily rely on the systems we've developed to operate in the margin for imports of all those? And would David Cameron agree with that?
I mean, I don't know. The answer is really, I think we reduce 90% of the risk we have in the world, okay, just brought down the level of debt. It's so simple. You can reduce a lot of risk in the economy with some measures. Here, I don't know about food supply or if you need more redundancies. It's not my job. I mean, maybe at dinner I would say I'd give my opinion a lot more freely than publicly what people should be doing. However, I mean, diversity needs to be increased locally, right? There's some work was done by Orlov about the inefficiencies of the Soviet system in agriculture allowed them, okay, to survive the turmoil of the transition phase, and how an over-optimized U.S. Economy, where all the oranges come from one place and all the apple from another place, okay, well, smooth and so on, can be very bad if you have social unrest in America. Okay, so far we haven't had social unrest. But so in other words, you have vulnerabilities to efficiency that need to be countered in some way. And how some countries can be blessed with an inefficient agriculture, like France, for example. Okay. So you can there are things. One thing I'd like to mention is I discovered after the Black Swan is that the diversity per square meter decreases, okay, as your space becomes larger. So in other words, the UK, it's an island, has more biodiversity per square meter than the continent, European continent. The European continent will have a lot more species than the UK, but proportionally much less. That should explain why globalization is reducing local diversity and why it can make things more fragile, because its concentration can be explosive. Okay, so you can counter it, but I don't want to go that route because it's not my department. So I'll do that at dinner, but not publicly.
David,
I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, what I take out of Black Swan thinking is not that these events are completely unknowable. You can think about risk and try and manage risk. In fact, Nassim says that the recent crash was not a black swan, actually. It was you foresaw it.
Yeah, it was white, yeah.
The point about food security and energy security, it's clear to me that we do live in a riskier world with respect to both food and energy, so we ought to have a policy about food security and a policy about energy security. At the moment in the UK, actually, we don't have any policy on food security at all. As I understand it, DEFRA doesn't really take a view at all about the level of food production in Britain, and I think that's a mistake. I think it should be thinking about food security, and we've said that quite specifically. A ditto on energy security. In a world where so much of our energy comes from very dangerous and unstable parts of the world, it clearly makes sense to have a robust approach on energy security and to plan for a diversity of energy supply. One of the things I like best about Black Swan is the point about after the event has taken place, we then rearrange our thinking and say, well, of course, it was always going to happen. And that's probably the quadrupling of the oil price in the 1970s. This is a sort of classic Black Swan, is that beforehand, no one predicted it, it happened. And then afterwards, of course, we then factor it into our thinking and into our historical view of the world. So yes, on both those, food security and energy security, clearly we need to have quite a robust approach. Because those are, even if you can't foresee what exactly will be the Black Swan, we know the energy, a lot of it is coming from dangerous parts of the world. We know that with climate change, food security is going to become more of an issue. So those are things that government should be thinking about.
Duncan Exley from Fair Pensions. One specifically for Mr. Cameron. We're aware that our financial services industry, including those who invest our pension funds for us, have previously been caught unawares by things that are not unforeseeable but were unanticipated. I'm interested in knowing what a Conservative government would put in place to ensure that investors put in place practices to anticipate the impacts of things that can be anticipated, like climate change, for example.
things that can be anticipated, like climate change, are in the market, as it were. They're being discussed, they're being talked about, they're being forecast. Many of these forecasts, as you might say, might be inaccurate, but nonetheless, investors, businesses, are able to make judgments based on quite widely available information. So I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
Well, it's largely based on some research our organisation did that showed that a lot of investors recognise that climate change would be a financial risk, but were a lot of them were doing little to actually anticipate it and treating it like a short-term problem, whereby I'd say it's a bit like giving up smoking. When you realise, when the effects become apparent, it's a little too late to do something about it.
That's true, but there's a danger. I mean, of course, the government has a role in terms of helping to publish this information about climate change and all the rest of it, but there's a danger with something like climate change where you can't be absolutely certain of the linearity of events that are going to take place, of governments sort of giving a hard and fast view about exactly what happens next. So I don't think that is possible. And in fact, if it did, it would almost certainly, according to your work, would almost certainly get it wrong.
Yeah, the idea is to be to say, okay, let's do no harm, okay, and default to what has been done for a long time. Like in climate change, say, okay, let's not pollute, okay. We don't understand what it's going to do to nature. We don't understand the effect, okay, and let's not tinker with it. Let's leave nature the way we got it, all right? That's the way we got it from our parents, and let's give it to our children the same way. So this is sort of the thinking, being hyper-conservative ecologically, okay, is the best defense.
This is the argument that even climate change skeptics should be actually in favor of taking action to mitigate climate change because of the unknowables that could take place. I mean, if you talk to the climate change experts, they will tell you that the global warming does not take place in a linear fashion. What you get is some extreme and completely asymmetric events. Because, for instance, if at a certain level of temperature the Greenland ice sheet melts more quickly, instead of getting a steady rise in the sea level, you get a very sharp rise in the sea level. So you can get some quite shocking, quite asymmetric events that would take place within climate change, which are, although you can predict the sort of things that might happen, you can't predict with certainty that they will happen. And this is an argument that even a skeptic should say, well, even if you're... I mean, the way that Al Gore explains it, he says, look, if someone told you there's a 70% chance of your house burning down, would you insure against it? Well, if most people would say, yes, of course I would. Well, it's the same with climate change. Even if you're 30% skeptical about climate change, it still makes sense to mitigate against its worst effects.
Paul Waugh from the Evening Standard. I wonder if Mr. Taleb has any advice for policymakers here and maybe in the US about what to do when they're confronted with a bank that's on the edge of collapse. I mean, David Cameron may not have to confront this problem, but we did have the problem with RBS, you had the problem with Northern Rock. There seems to be a consensus here that in some cases the state should have stepped in, yet that's not universal. What's your advice on that? Do you let banks fail? And a second one, which is to David, which is, I take it you don't agree with Mr. Taleb's views on the man-made element of climate change being a bit of a myth.
No, I don't agree with that. Yeah. You know that. Yeah. I get that.
I mean, my job is prevention. I'm not in an emergency room business. Okay, so I mean, I can tell the person how not to get in trouble. Okay, this is what to avoid. Once the person is in trouble, I don't know how. You know, it's not my specialty, but I can say that this crisis that we had is I was so upset. I was in Switzerland in Davos, and I had my credit card, and I realized that maybe I can't use my credit card. I can't understand why the U.S. government can protect my safety overseas, but cannot protect my financial safety. Okay. If there's a financial problem, why? Because of the banker's behavior, maybe we should have banking should be treated like utility. So I was not at some point, although I'm a conservative, I was not against the nationalization of the bank to strip that public function away from, so we no longer hijacked by bankers. and because they say, oh, they have so much risk, we depend so much on them. So instead of giving them money with TARP, you just take over the banks, okay? And, of course, make sure that people like me on the road can get cash out of the cash machine, right? Because that's the safety I wouldn't have, you know, from the bankers themselves, okay? I was not against that idea. Now, so take a government takeover is a good thing if you have a plan what to do with that bank, and make sure that you're removing the moral hazard, because keeping the banks in the hands of bankers hijacking us and trying to get more bonuses out of us was not a good idea. And unfortunately, in America, it's continuing. We subsidize, we gave them money for TARP, they took a lot of risk, they made money, they paid themselves bonuses with it. And now we got a thank you note from them. It was nice, all right, no more. So, you know, taking over, the government taking over banks is a good thing, provided there is a plan.
Graham Wilson from The Sun. We've heard a little bit about the risk of hyperinflation returning. Can I ask both men, given the unprecedented increase in national debt in the UK, the use of quantitative easing, how real the risk of hyperinflation is for the UK?
What I'm pointing at is that you're facing scenarios that are going to be extreme. So either you may have a massive deflation, which we're experiencing now, we're still experiencing deflation. You can have massive deflation, okay? And the remedies, whatever medicine you're using for that, may lead to hyperinflation. So you're facing two extreme outcomes that are not that opposite from each other, hyperinflation or deflation. Now, having mild inflation is, to me, would be ideal for any central banker. A mild inflation to take people out of their debt, in my opinion, is much harder to achieve because you can easily overshoot. And the metaphor I've used in the past is you're trying to land a plane on a very narrow strip, and you have the ocean and a mountain. So you're going to either land and, you know, crash into the mountain or land in the ocean. Okay, hitting your strip, which is mild inflation, is much harder to achieve today than it was in 1960.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a risk of hyperinflation. I haven't warned about that. But one thing I warned about was that you can get to a level of government debt where not that it becomes certain that people will cease to lend you the money, but you start running risks of them demanding higher premia, i.e. higher interest rates, or you run the risk of in some way not being able to meet your obligations. Now, I've never predicted that is going to happen. I've just said that as government borrowing goes up and up and up, you start running that risk, and you shouldn't be running that risk. And I've always used those words extremely carefully, because it's not something that I think is going to happen, but I think the government, with the level of indebtedness that they have, they are running those risks, but not the risk of hyperinflation, no.
Why not hyperinflation?
Because I think much more, I'm saying it's not more likely, but I think the risk, as I say, the risk you shouldn't run is that you will have difficulties in funding your deficit. And as the government now themselves talk about the need to reduce the deficit, it shows that actually they've started to accept my argument.
Julia Hobsbawm from Editorial Intelligence. I'm interested, I love your twin poles of the Brooklyn instinct-based experiential view of the world and the rather cookie-cutter MIT school of thought. It seems to me you're talking about culture and how much of cultural change can be taught so that, David Cameron, if and when you take over as Prime Minister, this country has more pragmatism than what you call the utopianism. In other words, are we in danger of just running out of a supply of the intelligence that you advocate, or can you in fact create a culture and indeed teach what is missing?
Well, one thing the danger of reading someone's book and it just confirms some of your prejudices, and that's why you like it. We were talking that beforehand. But one of the things I take out of Nassim's work is that because we live in this uncertain world with these large risks and unforeseen events that can do so much damage, when it comes to, for instance, regulation, what matters is not that you try and write every rule perfectly, because you'll never be able to foresee every eventuality, but what matters is, have you got good institutions and have you got wise people with good experience in them? And this seems to me, if you take, for example, financial regulation in the UK, I think that very much confirms our view. Would you want the strongest and wisest and most longest standing institution, i.e. the Bank of England, to be doing more of the regulating and to have a specific role on calling time on debt levels? And it seems to me that you've got to understand the importance of institutions and people rather than thinking it's all about rules. That was one of the things I drew out of your thinking.
I agree. I was a derivatives trader for a long time. Give me a regulation and I'll show you a way, you know, to make money, right? The regulation out there for lawyers and traders, all right? You go around it, okay? And you know, any regulation. And the second thing is that regulation actually is what got us here, regulators. With the value at risk, okay? Before the value at risk, people were paranoid about risk. Why they didn't understand. The value at risk institutionalized bad metrics. And also AAA, regulation is not a panacea and can be dangerous. But I agree, we should bet on people, not ideas. I mean, any conservative would tell you that. You ought to bet on people and on that mother elephant, all right? And the old elephant, not on some theoretician with a book. Okay, the system can be gamed.
Thank you. Peter Montagnan from the Association of British Insurers. We've heard that in this rather dangerous world, we'd be safer relying on equity than on debt. And my question is for David Cameron. It is, what is the role of government in getting us to a position where we are more reliant on equity, given that the incentives seem to be tilted so much in favour of debt, fiscal, regulatory and accounting incentives? Can government help, and in what way can government help change the incentives so we do rely more on equity?
Well, there are all sorts of issues about taxation and the way that we tax equity and debt that George has spoken about, and those are things that can be looked at. I think also there's a part of it is a cultural issue where, you know, for a very long period of time we had an attitude that debt was good, and it didn't matter how much the government was borrowing, how much individuals were borrowing, how much companies were borrowing, and not enough thinking was being done about what the effect of a bad shock to the economy would have. And, you know, I don't want to get too political at a gathering like this, but the fact that we went into this difficulty and into this recession with a borrowing requirement of 3% of our GDP, it's now looking like 14%. That's the real disgrace for the government. That is the real disgrace for Gordon Brown, that after this long period of steady economic growth, that we weren't actually at that stage at least in balance or paying back debt. So part of it is a cultural issue that needs to be set by government. And also, well, not just set by government, but helped by government. And also you need to encourage a savings culture. And we haven't had that in the UK either, and we desperately need that. And that's why there are some things that you can do. We argued before this budget that it would be a good idea to abolish income tax on the income people get from savings if they pay tax at the basic rate, because that would be good in the short term. It would help people whose incomes have fallen because interest rates are so low, but it would be good in the long term because that should be encouraging a savings culture. That was a suggestion we made before the last budget. So there are cultural things that you can do, there's leadership things you can do, and there are tax and other changes that you can look at in order to make sure that we have a savings and an equity culture and we don't become over-reliant on debt.
Well, that's all we've got time for this morning. Thank you very much indeed all for coming, and thanks everyone for asking short questions and not giving speeches, which is a low probability event of high impact as far as I'm concerned. But particularly, thank you to Nassim and to David for talking so interestingly and answering questions. Thank you very much, buddy.
Thank you very much.